On the 20th of January, 2025, Donald Trump was formally sworn into office once again as America's president. During his inaugural address to the nation that day, Trump presented his vision of America and set forth his goals for the next 4 years, including reestablishing American control over the Panama Canal. Merely minutes after Trump declared during this speech that his proudest legacy would be that of a peacemaker and a unifier, Trump said that it had been a foolish decision for America to have ever given the Panama Canal back to Panama, falsely claimed that 38,000 American lives have been lost during the canal's construction, said that America has been treated very badly from giving up the canal and that it should have never happened, that Panama's promises to the U.S. have been broken, that American ships using the canal are apparently being severely overcharged and not treated fairly, and that above all, China is allegedly operating the Panama Canal now, that America didn't give it to China, it was given to Panama, and that America is going to take it back, to thunderous applause. These comments and threats made by the President of the United States towards Panama came on the heels of multiple previous threats before he was sworn into office, including during a 7th of January press conference at his Mar-a-Lago personal residence, where Trump threatened to use economic coercion to force Panama into giving up its control of the canal, and where he very pointedly refused to rule out using military force against Panama to regain control over the canal either. In the weeks that have followed the president's statements, there has been much speculation about what Trump actually intends to do regarding the issue. Panama's president, José Raúl Mulino, has stated that every square meter of the canal belongs to Panama and will continue to do so, and he has flatly rejected even the thought of entering into any negotiations over it. He has also flatly rejected Trump's claims regarding Panama allegedly overcharging U.S. ships and allowing China to operate the canal. But the temperature is continuing to get hotter, while Trump's interest in the Panama Canal is not seeming to just go away. Trump's comments during his inaugural address concerning the Panama Canal were spoken like a late 19th century imperialist, and they might seem like they came completely out of nowhere. Before Trump started talking about the Panama Canal at the tail end of 2024, it hardly even registered in the minds of the American public at all, and it barely even made it onto the list of the top 500 most pressing strategic threats to most Americans. But quietly behind the scenes, for decades, the issue of Panama's control over the canal has long been deeply contentious within a sector of the United States government. And far from coming from the 19th century, Trump's modern threats towards Panama are rooted in history that is far more recent than you probably think. But in order to understand where Trump's very public threats towards taking over the Panama Canal are suddenly coming from, and what could actually end up happening, it helps to understand the historical and geopolitical context behind the comments, and America's own complex and controversial relationship with the country of Panama and the Panama Canal itself. For many centuries, the idea of carving out a canal across the narrow isthmus of Panama to create a shortcut between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans was heavily contemplated, but it was never technologically possible until the advent of the Industrial Revolution. The first serious attempt to build a canal across Panama was started by the French in 1881, but after 9 years of enormous effort and more than 20,000 workers who died in the process with little to show for it, the French abandoned the project by 1890 and went home. The U.S. government had always recognized the strategic and economic potential for a canal in Panama, since before its existence, the only way for America's Navy to move ships between its east and west coasts was to sail them the extremely long way around the entirety of South America, which greatly hampered the U.S. Navy's ability to quickly respond in force with all of its naval power at once during a crisis in either the Atlantic or the Pacific. Even a day with modern shipping technology, the Panama Canal saves about 16 days off of a ship's travel time between New York City and San Francisco, when compared to going the long way around South America. But America's interest in a canal across Panama increased even more dramatically during the administration of President William McKinley, arguably America's last openly imperialist president, and the only former president that Donald Trump mentioned at all during his 2025 inaugural address. McKinley led the United States into a victorious war against Spain in 1898, which led to the U.S. acquiring vast new territories around the world in Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines, while he also separately oversaw the U.S. annexation of Hawaii in the same year as well. After acquiring this vast new overseas empire at the tail end of the 19th century, America became more interested than ever in the Panama Canal project, as a maritime shortcut that would enable its navy to respond more rapidly to threats to the new far-flung territories. And so, just a few years later in 1902, the U.S. government began entering into negotiations with Colombia to take over the previous French-led effort at building that canal shortcut across the narrow isthmus of Panama, which at the time was still a part of Colombia. But after a year of negotiations, the Americans and Colombians couldn't come to an agreement on the terms of a deal. And after the Americans grew impatient, they decided to throw their military support behind the increasingly strong Panamanian independence movement instead. The U.S. essentially encouraged revolutionaries in Panama with promises of support to revolt against their Colombian overlords near the end of 1903. And then, they deployed the U.S. Navy on both the Atlantic and Pacific sides of the territory to prevent the Colombians from launching an amphibious assault to reassert their authority. With a virtually impassable, dense jungle of the Darien Gap separating Panama from Colombia by land, the large U.S. naval presence effectively made it impossible for the Colombians to re-enter Panama and to enforce their rule of law over the territory. Thus, depending on your point of view here, Panama became free to declare their independence or their secession from Colombia. But there were some strings attached by the Americans for their support. The newly independent Panama immediately entered into negotiations with their supposed protector, the United States, on the canal project. But then, with Panama under heavy duress and with America possessing immense leverage, the U.S. basically threatened Panama that if they didn't agree to the heavily American-favored terms of a canal treaty, the U.S. would just abandon them by withdrawing their navy and all of their military protection, which would basically throw them to the wolves of the vengeful Colombian government that they had just seceded from, who would probably be quite eager to come back and crush their independence. So, effectively forced into choosing between their independence with American control over the canal, or complete resubjugation under a furious Colombia, the independence leaders of Panama at the time chose the former, and what they probably believed was the lesser of two evils. So, near the end of 1903, Panama, under this duress in the United States, signed the Hay-Bunau-Varilla Treaty, in which Panama granted the United States full sovereign control over an area of land in the country covering 5 miles on either side of the planned canal route in perpetuity, but excluding the cities of Panama City in the south and Colón in the north. This strip of land stretching clear across the Isthmus of Panama became known as the Panama Canal Zone. And it effectively became an overseas, fully sovereign territory of the United States that enabled the U.S. to construct the Panama Canal through it fully within sovereign American territory. The U.S. agreed to pay Panama $10 million up front and $250,000 a year in return for the territory in perpetuity. And then the U.S. finished constructing the canal through the territory a decade later by 1914, but at immense costs in both capital and in human lives. The U.S. spent nearly $500 million at the time on the canal's construction, equivalent to about $15.2 billion in today's money, while around 5,600 workers were believed to have been killed during the American period of construction due to accidents and diseases, with the overwhelming majority of those fatalities being workers who were brought in from the Caribbean region, rather than Americans. From then on, throughout the era of American control, the Panama Canal Zone was primarily an asset of the U.S. Navy and military that was frequently seen as vital for rapidly redeploying American military assets from the East Coast to conflicts in Asia, like during World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. But the Canal Zone's status as effectively a permanent outpost of the U.S. military in the middle of Panama also began causing significant unrest with local Panamanians later on in the 20th century, too. And it became a potent symbol of lingering U.S. imperialism in Latin America as the world entered into the Cold War. At a little more than 1,400 square kilometers in size, the Panama Canal Zone was a little larger than the contemporary British colony of Hong Kong. It was a heavily racially segregated exclave of the United States full of U.S. military bases that sliced Panama in half geographically, complete with its own independent courts, police, and government. In the 1950s, during the era of decolonization that was sweeping throughout Africa and Asia, it seemed supremely hypocritical that the United States government was openly in favor of European countries relinquishing their African and Asian colonies while they continued hanging on to the Panama Canal Zone. And so, Panamanian anger at the continued indefinite American control over a large segment of their country began evolving into protests. And in January of 1964, the building anger finally reached a boiling point. In response to the Canal Zone administration not allowing a high school in the Canal Zone to fly the Panamanian flag alongside of the American flag, a group of young Panamanian students decided that they would march to the Canal Zone's entrance in protest. But those protests quickly evolved into multiple days of deadly riots between the Panamanian people and the U.S. Army, in which millions of dollars worth of property was destroyed and in which 22 Panamanian protesters and 4 American soldiers were killed, and hundreds of Panamanians were injured. The event is still regarded as a sacred occasion in Panama to this day, and is still commemorated every year in the country as Martyrs Day. After those events, Panama severed its diplomatic relations with the United States and stated that they would never be restored until the U.S. agreed to begin negotiations on returning the canal. The LBJ administration in the United States at that time recognized that if the canal continued remaining in American hands, the building anger rising in Panama at their presence would never just go away, and they'd have to keep using the army to intervene forcefully from time to time to safeguard it, which didn't exactly look very good in the greater region of Latin America that the United States was increasingly finding itself in Cold War competition over with the Soviets. As a result, the LBJ administration eventually came to an agreement that would have actually restored Panama's sovereignty over the canal zone. But then, Panama's civilian government was overthrown during a military coup in 1968, and the agreement was never ratified. A few years later, in 1973, during the Nixon administration, the United States even used its position on the UN Security Council to veto a UNSC resolution that would have demanded the U.S. return the canal back to Panama. The international pressure and the rising temperature in Panama itself were both mounting on the U.S. position in Panama. And even Henry Kissinger himself, perhaps America's most controversial ever Secretary of State, absolutely poured himself into negotiations to return the canal back to Panama. In 1975, he famously warned the Ford administration that there would soon be riots all over Latin America if the United States didn't renegotiate the original canal treaty with Panama. This was the heated atmosphere around Panama that Jimmy Carter found himself in when he entered the presidency in 1977, and he, more than any of his predecessors, was determined to finally resolve the issue. Far from the naive gift that some people have since tried to paint Carter's decision to return the canal as, it was a highly strategic decision at the time to try and improve America's global image and its relations with Latin America, at a time of fierce geopolitical competition throughout the region with the Soviets. So, later on in 1977, Carter and the de facto leader of Panama at the time came together and finally signed the Torrijos-Carter Treaties, which were ratified by the U.S. Senate the following year in 1978 and did several things. The Carter Treaties dissolved the area of the canal zone and returned all of the land in the zone back to Panama the following year in 1979, while control over the Panama Canal itself would become jointly administered between both the U.S. and Panama until the final day of the millennium on the 31st of December, 1999, when at noon, during a formal ceremony, the canal's full control was finally handed over entirely to Panama. The Carter Treaties also enshrined a status of permanent legal neutrality over the canal, enabling it to be freely used equally by all of the nations in the world, while the United States was given the authority to defend the canal's neutrality militarily if it were ever to be threatened. But Carter's decision to hand the canal back over to Panama was not a universally popular decision back in the U.S. One of the fiercest critics of the decision at the time was none other than Ronald Reagan. When he was running for president in 1976, he made retaining America's control over the Panama Canal one of his most central foreign policy slogans, repeatedly saying in his speeches to thunderous applause, "We built it, we paid for it, and we're going to keep it." Reagan's conservative wing of the Republican Party weaponized Carter's and the Democrats' decision to return the canal to Panama as an effective means to raise campaign money and enthusiasm. But then, once he became president, Reagan never took any serious action to actually reverse Carter's decision on the issue. It was entirely a campaign talking point for him to attack the Democrats with. And Trump might find that his modern comments about the canal have a similar political value that he feels particularly resonates with his very pro-Reagan base. Trump's threats about not ruling out military force to take back the canal today appear to most Americans as being completely out of left field. But most Americans have also forgotten that it wasn't really that long ago since the last time the U.S. military launched a full-scale invasion into Panama. But pretty much every Panamanian today over the age of 40 remembers well the night of the 20th of December 1989, when tens of thousands of American soldiers invaded their country. The then dictator of Panama, Manuel Noriega, had once been a close ally of the United States and was even an informant for the CIA. But after it was revealed in the late 1980s that he was actually a drug trafficking kingpin, relations began to deteriorate and he began shifting Panama's geopolitical alignment closer to Cuba, Nicaragua, and the Soviet Union instead. Tensions began simmering, and in 1989, Noriega annulled the results of Panama's general elections that appeared to show his party losing, transitioning him into a full-blown dictator in the process who is deeply unpopular with most of his own people. The George H.W. Bush administration demanded that Noriega step down from power, and after an American soldier was killed by Panamanian forces at a roadblock in the country in December, the Pentagon finally decided that the time had come to remove Noriega by force. Codenamed Operation Just Cause, 26,000 American soldiers stormed into Panama overnight on the 20th of December, 1989, with guns blazing and rapidly overwhelmed Noriega's government forces. Noriega himself was captured and extradited to the United States to face trial in prison, while 23 American soldiers were killed and another 324 others wounded. True to their word, the United States did not take advantage of the situation after they found themselves occupying Panama. All of the previous Carter-era treaties regarding the canal were upheld, and democracy was fully restored to Panama. While the invasion itself that toppled the dictator Noriega was broadly popular in Panama at the time. Nonetheless, in addition to the around 300 Panamanian soldiers who were killed during the invasion, around 214 Panamanian civilians were also killed by the fighting, a very large number of them in a densely populated neighborhood in Panama City that caught on fire. At the time, and in the greater context of the American invasion being seen as a restoration of democracy mission, this tragedy was generally accepted as a tragic incident of collateral damage. But during a potential Trump-authorized mission to seize the Panama Canal in a land grab today, such incidents of civilian fatalities in the densely populated cities that surround the canal would be met with nothing less than the absolute fury of the Panamanians today. And since the canal was fully transferred over by the Americans to complete Panamanian control at the end of 1999, the Panamanians themselves have completely transformed the canal from just being a tool of the US military into that, plus a major global trade artery that it never really was beforehand. The Panamanian government invested $5 billion of their own money into expanding the Panama Canal with a wider system of locks that opened up in 2016 that have enabled larger container vessels than ever before to transit through it. Now, because the canal currently represents the fastest maritime trade route between China and the U.S. East Coast and Brazil, it's since gotten to the point where about 13,000 vessels, or around 6% of all global maritime trade, will pass through the canal now in a given year, which provides roughly $2.5 billion worth of annual revenues to the Panamanian government in the form of tolls and fees. The canal now comprises roughly 7.7% of Panama's entire annual GDP, and it's also a tremendous symbol of pride for the small country. But the canal also remains critical to the U.S. economy and military today as well. 40% of all U.S. container traffic continues to pass through the canal per year. The United States also continues to remain by far the canal's largest single user, while the U.S. military still uses the canal extensively to rapidly redeploy its fleet of nuclear submarines and warships between the Atlantic and Pacific theaters. Now, this gets us back to Trump's two principal allegations and complaints towards the Panama Canal today: that Panama is allegedly overcharging U.S. merchant and naval vessels to use the canal, and that the Chinese military is secretly controlling the canal. Before he took office, Trump warned that if Panama didn't reduce the rates they were charging American ships to use the canal before he assumed office, he would demand that the U.S. be returned the Panama Canal, quote, in full and without question. So, let's address the first of Trump's claims here, that Panama is allegedly overcharging American vessels that are using the canal. It is true that over the last couple of years, Panama has been raising the prices they charge on ships passing through the canal, but that's almost entirely been because the canal is fed by a large freshwater lake nearby to it called Lake Gatun. And due to a recent serious drought in Panama, the lake's water levels have been significantly declining, which has reduced the physical limit to the number of transits through the canal that can actually happen. Less transits through the canal being possible because of physics and a steady demand inevitably meant that toll prices were going to have to rise, and Panama raised their prices evenly across the board for all ships, regardless of their national origin. Trump has argued that American ships using the canal should not have been subjected to these evenly distributed price increases, since American ships are by far the canal's largest customer. But American ships were never specifically singled out for price increases over every other nation's ships. Panamanian authorities have also suggested that even if they wanted to give preferential rates to American ships using the canal, it would almost certainly violate the 1977 Carter-Torrijos treaties that legally enshrined the canal's permanent neutrality status. Giving American ships using the canal preferential rates over other nations would probably be seen as a violation of the canal's neutrality internationally, and there's almost no telling what kinds of unforeseen chaos that could lead to. Moreover, American warships have hardly paid anything to actually use the Panama Canal recently either. Over the past 9 years combined, going back to 2016, the U.S. Navy has only paid about $17 million worth of transit fees to Panama to use the canal, which, in the infamously bloated world of the U.S. military spending, is basically little more than a rounding error. Now, let's address the other claim about the Panama Canal that Trump has been using recently to justify a potential American reacquisition of it through force, that it's supposedly being run by Chinese soldiers rather than by Panama itself. This is, to put it simply, not true, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a small kernel of truth behind Trump's statements and concerns here. It is a fact that recently, Panama has been greatly increasing their relations with China. During Trump's first term in office in 2017, Panama severed its relations with Taiwan and chose to extend its diplomatic recognition of the communist Chinese government based on the mainland instead, while the Panamanians only informed the American ambassador to their country about the decision a mere hour beforehand. And since then, China has made significant economic inroads into Panama. Panama became the very first country in Latin America to join on with China's Belt and Road Initiative investment program, and China's President Xi Jinping personally visited Panama himself in 2019. Since joining the Belt and Road Initiative, China has invested around $1.4 billion into Panamanian infrastructure programs, compared against the $3.8 billion of total lifetime direct foreign investment into Panama from the United States, meaning that China has been rapidly catching up with American investment in the country. China has also become the second largest user of the Panama Canal itself, though it still distantly trails the use of the United States. In the 1990s, as Panama was preparing to assume full control over the canal from the U.S., the Panamanian government held bidding processes to operate cargo terminals and ports along and near the canal. Several international companies won rights to these facilities during this process, but among them was a company called Hutchison Ports, a private company that is a subsidiary of the conglomerate CK Hutchison Holdings that's based in the semi-autonomous Chinese city of Hong Kong, who, in 1997, won the rights to manage two of the ports in Panama on behalf of the Panamanian government, one at Cristobal on the Atlantic side and another at Balboa on the Pacific side. At the time, the awarding of these ports to a Chinese company based in Hong Kong on opposite ends of the Panama Canal rose alarm bells in Washington. But after the U.S. State Department at the time extensively researched the issue, they released a report in 1999 just before the handover that concluded, quote, "We have not uncovered any evidence to support a conclusion that the People's Republic of China will be in a position to control canal operation," end quote. However, CK Hutchison acquired the rights to those Panamanian ports during a time when Hong Kong was still a firmly autonomous city within China that maintained significant separation from the Chinese Communist Party and the mainland. More recently, since 2020, however, after China passed the Hong Kong National Security Law, the Chinese Communist Party has dramatically increased their direct control over Hong Kong, and Hong Kong's prior autonomous status has been severely compromised, which has led to the probability of much heavier Chinese government influence extending into Hong Kong-based companies than beforehand, like CK Hutchison. The U.S. government was then further alarmed in 2021, when Panama renewed CK Hutchison's concessions to the ports for another 25 years, extending them into 2046. On their own, there's nothing that's necessarily nefarious about CK Hutchison's control of these ports. In addition to the two that they operate in Panama, they operate another 51 other ports all around the world, throughout Europe, Latin America, Africa, Asia, and Australia. But that hasn't silenced the national security alarm bells being ringed in America over their ports in Panama. The new American Secretary of State, selected by the Trump administration, Marco Rubio, said during his recent confirmation hearing in the Senate, quote, "If these companies control both ends of that canal in a time of conflict and the Chinese tell them, shut it down and don't let the U.S. go through there, we've got a big, big problem. A big economic problem and a big national security and defense problem," end quote. He also argued that China could use the ports to, quote, "turn the canal into a choke point in a moment of conflict, and that is a direct threat to the national security of the United States," end quote. Now, while the ports CK Hutchison operates are indeed at opposite geographic ends of the canal, they are not in themselves gateways to enter into or exit out of the canal. They are ports that handle and process cargo, and ships don't have to pass through either of them in order to enter or exit the canal. But that isn't to say that they aren't still a potential threat to America's interests. During a potential time of war, or in the events leading up to one, the Chinese government could apply pressure on CK Hutchison or even nationalize the company to exploit its assets, like the ports in Panama. The People's Liberation Army could hide soldiers or saboteurs amongst the port's workers. And with China's increased grip over Hong Kong, the fear is that CK Hutchison is in no position to ever tell Beijing no. Already as it is, the ports on either end of the canal could report directly to Beijing the types and frequency of American warships and submarines transiting through the canal, potentially giving China an idea of which ocean America's warships and submarine fleets are in at a given time. In the lead-up to a war over Taiwan, it's conceivable that China could intentionally use a ship to ram into one of the bridges that crosses over the canal, like what happened in March of 2024 when a container ship lost power and hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which caused the bridge's collapse and closed the port of Baltimore to maritime traffic for the next 11 weeks. China could also deliberately crash a ship within the Panama Canal, like the accidental crash that took place in the Suez Canal back in 2021, when a crashed container ship completely blocked the Suez Canal for more than 6 days. In the lead-up to a war over Taiwan's future, the U.S. Navy would absolutely use the Panama Canal to most rapidly transfer warships and submarines from the East Coast into the Pacific. If a covert Chinese military operation based out of one of CK Hutchison's ports in Panama managed to successfully sabotage the canal, however, it could potentially prove to be decisive. It would force American warships and submarines on the East Coast to take the much longer journey to the Pacific around the whole of South America. That would add an extra 16 days onto their travel time. 16 critical extra days worth of time that would enable the People's Liberation Army Navy to assault Taiwan without having to worry about significant American reinforcements arriving from the East Coast. It is this particular concern that's attracted the fury and the attention of the new Trump administration in Panama. But there are many, many other options on the table that the United States could take to resolve this fear short of a full-blown invasion, taking the canal back through force. The U.S. or Panama, or both of them together, could always just offer to try and buy out the CK Hutchison ports to remove China's presence that way. The company could always refuse a buyout, though, perhaps under pressure by the Chinese government. And in that scenario, the Panamanian government could consider just nationalizing the ports with an appropriate level of compensation. Under this nationalization scenario, Panama would need substantial support from the United States to even consider it, because China would almost certainly be incredibly outraged, while other companies would be worried about the precedent set that Panama could suddenly nationalize their own assets as well. One way that Panama has been seemingly trying to cool down the temperature and appease Trump has been by announcing that they'll launch a financial audit into CK Hutchison's ports in the country. It's possible that that audit could produce grounds for the Panamanian government to revoke the company's concessions to the ports, and presumably appease Trump and the United States in the process. But it also could just turn up nothing, too. The U.S. government could also demand that Panama implement stricter background checks on the workers employed by the Chinese-run ports, too. And, of course, Trump could also resort to either economic or military force to take over the canal as well. Economic force would likely not be a very effective path to pursue here, though. If the U.S. imposed sanctions on Panama over the issue, it's almost certain that they would be completely unilateral and that no other country in the world would ever join in on them, unlike the U.S. sanctions regimes on other countries like Russia, Iran, or North Korea. This would undermine the U.S. sanctions on Panama because Panama could always just trade with just about any other country they wanted. And it would, without a question, push Panama away from being what is today a close U.S. ally and partner, and push them even further into the hands of China instead, worsening Trump's base level of complaints about the situation even further. Without a question, though, the absolute worst option on the table that the Trump administration could possibly pursue would be a full-blown invasion of Panama to take the canal back through military force. First of all, prior to Trump's recent comments, Panama was overall a pretty staunchly pro-American country. Their president is a conservative, while the mayor of Panama City, the largest city in the country, has openly been a huge fan of Trump and America on his social media profiles. Panama has also cooperated extensively with the U.S. on restricting migration through the Darien Gap, the treacherous wild jungle of a passageway that most migrants from Venezuela, Haiti, and Ecuador take from Colombia on their journeys towards the United States. If the U.S. military invades Panama and forcefully seizes the canal, this cooperation in the Darien Gap will be ruptured permanently. By going back on its word so flagrantly on the 1977 Carter-Trujillo treaties, the U.S. would also cause irreparable diplomatic and reputational damage to its own global image. Trump's arguments of the Panama Canal being historically American and retaking what should rightfully belong to the United States would appear no different at all from Vladimir Putin's arguments about retaking historical Russian territory in Ukraine, or Xi Jinping's arguments about retaking historical Chinese territory in Taiwan or the South China Sea, all of which would catastrophically undermine America's diplomatic soft power in the world, and would more than anything else highlight America's hypocrisy for all of the world to see. In theory, an armed American invasion into Panama today would be even easier to accomplish than it was the last time 36 years ago, back in 1989. Panama doesn't have any standing army at all today. It only maintains a small, lightly armed internal security force with limited equipment and an annual budget that's only equivalent to about 5 hours worth of the U.S. military spending. The U.S. military could rapidly overwhelm Panama and seize control back over the canal if they really wanted to. But that would only be the very beginning of the nightmare that would then follow. Unlike America's 1989 invasion of Panama that overthrew an unpopular dictator and restored the country's democracy, a modern invasion to seize control over the Panama Canal would only be seen as nothing other than an imperialist land grab. Major urban environments exist around the canal, including Panama City, with more than 1 million people directly adjacent to the Pacific side's entrance. Damage could be caused to civilians in the area, while the invading force would inevitably be met with massive and potentially violent protests very near to the theater of operations. If the Panama Canal Zone's territory was restored by the invaders, they would find themselves in a small enclave completely surrounded by more than 4.3 million furious Panamanians. An armed insurgency against America's regained control of the canal would almost certainly become inevitable, and the U.S. would find itself in a brand new quagmire attempting to constantly defend the canal for an indefinite amount of time. Modern offensive technology will also make protecting the canal against a hostile Panamanian population in the millions even more difficult than it was in the past. The world has recently observed the power of drones that the Ukrainians have weaponized against Russia and that the Houthis in Yemen have weaponized against ships in the Red Sea. Insurgent Panamanians, potentially armed and supported by America's enemies abroad, would make frequent attempts to sabotage the canal's operations, and they would inevitably end up using cheap, explosive drones to constantly attack the canal itself and American warships and submarines transiting through it. Panamanian insurgents could attack the canal enough to make it impossible for insurance companies to agree to insure anything that passes through it. Similar to what the Houthis have already done with drones in the Red Sea, or what the Ukrainians have done with drones in the Black Sea. It would literally turn into a constant military nightmare for the U.S. trying to maintain its hold over the restored canal zone. And it would require a constant, heavy U.S. military presence permanently deployed there, and constantly fighting that would be very costly in terms of both lives and money. Panama will never negotiate on relinquishing their control over the canal ever again. The canal is fundamental both to Panama's modern identity and to Panama's modern way of life. There is simply no scenario in which Panama will agree to give the canal up or to sell it. And that means that Trump's threats towards Panama are either meant to pressure them into cutting their ties with China and kicking out those Chinese-owned ports, or he really is serious about actually invading. Since Panama simply won't negotiate or sell the canal, Trump's only actual option of returning the Panama Canal back to American control will be the military option. And that's also the absolute worst decision that could possibly be made. And everyone with any potential influence here should do everything they can to ensure that that option is never actually allowed to happen. Over the past month, with all of Trump's comments and actions since he reassumed the American presidency, it seems that a normal year's worth of events have all been condensed into just a matter of weeks. Through January alone, we not only had Trump's threats about reclaiming the Panama Canal, but Trump's threats towards establishing American control over Greenland as well. The tariff showdown that Trump launched against Canada, Mexico, and China, while we also saw the start of the first long-lasting ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, after 15 months of nearly continuous war between them. We saw the Houthis in Yemen de-escalating by announcing that they would cease attacking American and British maritime shipping in the Red Sea, while we also saw the Russians gaining significant ground in eastern Ukraine, with the capture of several strategic cities in the Donbass theater, like Toretsk and Chasiv Yar. While we also saw the U.S. conclude that the Rapid Support Forces in the Sudanese Civil War were guilty of committing genocide in Darfur. While Rwandan-backed rebels in the Democratic Republic of the Congo captured control over a huge city with a population of over 1 million people. Every month, So many important things are currently happening, from developing conflicts around the world, that it's almost impossible to actually keep up with it all, no matter how well-informed you try to be. I wanted to start creating one new video a month that covers all of these increasingly major developments from conflicts taking place around the world, to help you stay as up-to-date as possible on what's taking place in our world and why during this time of global conflict. And that's why I created my new War Room series, a monthly video briefing series that covers all of the most significant geopolitical updates from conflicts taking place around the world that you need to be the most well-informed about. The latest episode in this series covers all of the most important conflict developments that took place last month throughout January that you might have otherwise missed in the noise. But unfortunately, due to the inherently violent, controversial, and obviously very recent nature of discussing in detail the evolving developments of ongoing global conflicts, a series covering all of this on YouTube would almost certainly become demonetized and age-restricted, which ultimately would mean that YouTube's algorithm would never promote the series to you and you would probably never get to see any of it. But thankfully, I was still able to produce this series every month anyway because of the power of this video's sponsor, Nebula, where you can go and watch the January episode of War Room right now. I'm also releasing new episodes in War Room over there, covering major global conflict updates every single month. While I also have dozens of exclusive, full-length real-life lore documentaries on Nebula as well in my separate Modern Conflict series, giving you deep dives into major recent conflicts that would otherwise also be demonetized and age-restricted if they were on YouTube. With current documentaries ranging from the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war, to Israel's wars with Hamas, to the Myanmar, Sudan, Yemen, and Syria civil wars, and tons of others, with new episodes getting released every single month as well. And what's even more, you also get access to all of the other amazing exclusive content that's available on Nebula, because the best part about this site is that it's jointly co-owned by all of its creators, built by myself and hundreds of other YouTubers and podcasters. And because it's a subscription-based service, we all get to work on way bigger and higher budget productions over there than we could ever do on YouTube. That's why there's tons of other exclusive content that you'll find equally fascinating from all these other creators over there you probably also already know as well. And best of all, if you sign up by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now or by following the link that's down below in the description, you'll receive an insane 40% discount off of an annual subscription, which means it'll only cost you $3 a month or $36 a year for all of this awesome exclusive content from myself and hundreds of other independent creators, with even more stuff getting added every single month. And if you already have a Nebula subscription and you want to gift one to a friend or a loved one, you can now do that as well with a gifted subscription with the same discount by following the link that's down below in the description as well. It's the absolute best way to help support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. And as always, thank you so much for watching.